You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free. Welcome to the Director Series podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
After his permanent relocation to England in the mid-1960s, Kubrick began accumulating a reputation in the media as an eccentric recluse. He valued his privacy as well as the time it took to perfect his vision on a given work, which the newspapers regularly embellished as the controlling nature of a megalomaniacal artist. Because Kubrick didn't do anything to dispel these rumors, this false reputation only grew until it attained the power of myth. It would take Kubrick 12 years to realize another project after Full Metal Jacket, and the long period of silence from the Maverick auteur led the film world to wonder just exactly what he was up to all this time. The hype machine kicked into overdrive when Kubrick announced that his next project, and unbeknownst to him, his last, would be Eyes Wide Shut, a cautionary tale about infidelity and sexuality set among the strata of New York City's elite.
Because I'm a beautiful woman, the only reason any man ever wants to talk to me is because he wants to fuck me? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't think it's quite that black and white, but I think we both know what men are like.
So on that basis, I should conclude that you wanted to fuck those two models.
There are exceptions.
Kubrick based the film on a novel by Arthur Schnitzler titled Traum Nouvelle, or Dream Story, which he had optioned way back in the 1960s. Collaborating with writer Frederick Raphael and his producing partner and brother-in-law, Jan Harlan, Kubrick began rolling film on his 14th and final feature in 1996. Kubrick had a habit throughout his career of picking leading men that were just left of center, in terms of popularity or stardom. The two biggest stars he had worked with up to that point had been Kirk Douglas and Jack Nicholson, and even then both men paled in comparison to the blinding glow of Hollywood superstar Tom Cruise's celebrity.
Well, Victor, maybe I'm missing something here. You called it a fake, a charade. Do you mind telling me what kind of fucking charade ends with somebody turning up dead?
Cruise was already famous before Eyes Wide Shut, but he would lay down any affectations of vanity in full service to Kubrick's harrowing vision. As wealthy Gothamite Dr. Bill Harford, Cruise explores the darker side of his charismatic psyche, his iconic, toothy grin now becoming a hollow facade for the tortured soul behind it. Kubrick's canny harnessing of Cruise's manic intensity and dedication results in one of the finest performances of Cruise's career. The same can be said of Cruise's then-wife Nicole Kidman, who plays Alice Harper. The role of Alice is a particularly vulnerable one, as it requires her to be completely nude throughout a good deal of the film. But Kidman shuns any sense of modesty and flaunts her stuff confidently.
I must see you again.
That's impossible.
Why?
Because I'm married.
She's perfectly believable as the glamorous wife of a wealthy doctor, but Kubrick has the good sense to give her a nuanced role all her own. Her pragmatic sensuality exerts an unspeakable power over Bell, and while Cruise and Kidman would not pan out as a couple in the long run, their charged chemistry in Eyes Wide Shut is captivating.
Nightingale.
With supporting roles of Nick Nightingale and Victor Ziegler, Kubrick turned to two fellow directors, Todd Field and Sidney Pollack. Field wasn't exactly a director himself during the making of Eyes Wide Shut, but he would prove his bona fides with his later award-winning works, In the Bedroom and Little Children.
Hey man, I just played the piano.
In Eyes Wide Shut, Fields' Nick Nightingale is a med school buddy of Bill's who dropped out to become a jazz piano player. Field doesn't have much to do in the way of characterization, but the role is instrumental in pushing Bill headlong into his dark adventure.
I can't thank you enough for this. You, saved my ass.
Oh, I'm glad I was here.
And Bill, I probably... Oh, I know I don't have to mention this, but this is just between us, okay?
By contrast, Pollock was already an Oscar-winning director at the time, having held 1985's Out of Africa and 1982's Tootsie, and he had previously directed Kreese himself in The Firm. As Victor Ziegler, Pollock proves that he's equally adept in front of the camera, channeling a mild-mannered kind of antagonism towards Kreese as the good doctor threatens to expose his participation in a secret sex cult.
I know what happened last night. And I know what's been going on since then. And I think you just might have the wrong idea about one or two things.
The visual style of Eyes Wide Shut, besides being inherently Kubrickian in conception and execution, reads like a Baroque old world nightmare. In selecting his director of photography, Kubrick continues his tradition of pulling from John Alcott's camera crew. Just as he promoted focus puller Douglas Milsom to lens Full Metal Jacket, Kubrick calls up Larry Smith, who served as the gaffer on Barry Lyndon and The Shining. After 12 years away from a film set, Kubrick manages to retain all the visual conceits he has made into his signature. Alluring one-point perspective compositions, the frequent use of Steadicam rigs, zooms, both slow and fast, extended tracking shots, and elegant dolly work. The camera floats dispassionately as it observes the action, creating the distinct impression of an omniscient observer. Indeed, the floating nature of the camera echoes the floating nature of dreams themselves, and Kubrick's kinetic perfection here, when combined with the sumptuous blend of oranges, reds, purples, soft focus setups, and Christmas lights everywhere, generates a hazy, ethereal patina. Kubrick's production designer on The Shining, Roy Walker, returns to provide his exceptional set-building talents in collaboration with Leslie Tompkins. The director's preference for controlling every single aspect of his shoots often meant that sound stages were the only option. The deception of theatricality is a major theme of Eyes Wide Shut, which is reflected in the fact that the film was made entirely on sound stages. Even the streets of New York City were recreated in painstaking detail. At the same time, Kubrick doesn't bother to hide the artifice of the process. Instead, he embraces it as an aesthetic conceit. The streets in New York and Eyes Wide Shut feel like less of an actual place and more like someone's memory of the city, recalled in a daydream. That same dreamlike approach extends the intense, unnaturally blue moonlight that filters through windows, or the blatantly fake taxicab sequence, or even that one very noticeable walking shot, all which employ rear projection to give the illusion of movement. By 1996, rear projection was already an obsolete technology, but Kubrick's inspired use of it subtly reinforces our suspicions that all may quite not be what it appears. Contemporary classical composer Jocelyn Pook is credited for the film's music, but Kubrick once again uses a variety of pre-existing classical works. Some are appropriations of Pook's existing work, like the creepy piano chord plunks that symbolize the ominous omniscience of the secret of sex cult. The orgy sequence itself is scored with a recording of an Orthodox Mass in Romanian played backwards, lending a spooky, satanic vibe to the ritualistic nature of the party.
Honey, you see my wallet?
Isn't it on the bedside table?
Now listen, you know we're running a little late.
Kubrick also uses a piece by Dmitri Shostakovich, Jazz Suite Waltz 2, as the de facto theme of the film, forever linking underappreciated classical music with his indelible images. Quite simply, no one ever has, and perhaps ever will, use classical music as effectively as Kubrick.
Did you give Roz the phone and pager numbers?
Yeah, I put it on the fridge.
They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing.
Finally, Chris Isaak's brooding rock track, Baby Did a Bad Bad Thing, is used during a brief love scene between Cruise and Kidman, adding an edgy modernism to Eyes Wide Shut's musical landscape. Just as Full Metal Jacket devoted itself solely to the exploration of violence, so does Eyes Wide Shut single-mindedly attack the other end of the totem pole, sex. Whereas previous films like Lolita and Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, dance around the subject of sexuality with winking innuendo, Eyes Wide Shut confronts the topic head-on, beginning from the opening shot of Kidman's nude backside and continuing all the way up until the closing shot.
There is something very important that we need to do as soon as possible.
What's that?
Fuck.
Eyes Wide Shut defines its exploration of sexuality through the prism of marriage and the institutions built around it. Kubrick makes a stark contrast between the lurid, rampant promiscuity of the mansion sex party and the quiet, comfortable intimacy of Alice and Bill's bedroom. In the mansion, secrets are created, and in the bedroom, secrets are divulged. The specter of infidelity cleaves like a dagger through the Harfords' marriage, setting them each off on a journey of self-exploration and discovery to ultimately arrive back at a stronger place than they were before. The nature of said journeys also reflects the differences in gender in terms of arousal.
He glanced at me as he walked past, just a glance. But I could hardly move. That afternoon, Helena went to the movies with her friend, and you and I made love. No time was he ever out of my mind.
Alice's fantasy dreams reflect the psychological, intangible aspects of attraction, a trait often described as feminine. While Tom's close calls with the hooker played by Vanessa Shaw, or his experience at the mansion party, reflect impersonal, transactional attitudes towards sex that are often attributed to the masculine psyche. The placing of Alice and Bill among the social circles of New York City's elite can be read as a distinctly Kubrickian move that affords him the opportunity to indulge in gilded Baroque production design and images of dancing aristocrats. Like 2001: A Space Odyssey or The Shining before it, a supernatural mystique courses through Eyes Wide Shut. The coded iconography of dreams allows Kubrick to cast a naturalistic eye on spooky images like the hedonistic ritualism of the mansion sex party, or the ominous masks worn by its attendees. The masks themselves were based on those that one might see at the Carnival of Venice, which coincides quite nicely with the old-world supernaturalism that Kubrick is after here, along with the not-so-subtle allusions to the Illuminati. Indeed, masks play a key role in the story of Eyes Wide Shut. The film is a commentary on the masks that we wear, that of the loving wife, or the devoted father, or the principled member of society's upper crust. These masks give us our identity. Without them, we are anonymous, and our anonymity reveals us as we really are, mere animals, vulnerable to our primitive instincts and desires. Eyes Wide Shut takes place on the city streets and in the sky-high apartments of New York City, but Kubrick's fascination with the myth of the Minotaur and the Labyrinth still informs the film on a fundamental level.
Ladies, where exactly are we going?
Exactly. Where the rainbow ends.
It's no coincidence that Bill Harford is beckoned to Where the Rainbow Ends by two drunken, seductive models during the film's opening at the Christmas ball, only for him to later wind up buying his costume for the mansion orgy at a shop literally called Rainbows. He's followed the rainbow to its end, only to find a rabbit hole that leads deeper and deeper into the labyrinth. As Harford meanders the cold city streets on his many head-clearing walks, Kubrick shows the streets themselves as something of a maze. Like the hedge maze in The Shining, Harford's surroundings look the same at every turn, and he never quite understands that he's walking in circles. As long as he allows himself to be consumed by the mystery, he will never escape this labyrinth. Only, he's not on a confrontation course with a Minotaur. Bill's internal battles with his jealousy and suspicion means that he is a Minotaur. Whereas Kubrick's prior films have been about his protagonists entering the labyrinth to slay their Minotaurs, His final film allows the Minotaur to free himself from the tyranny of the Labyrinth entirely. Despite the behind-the-scenes drama of the production breaking 400 shoot days, and a Guinness World Record in the process, Kubrick was immensely proud of Eyes Wide Shut. He allegedly considered it to be his best film. It was a homecoming of sorts for the director, taking place in his native New York City, despite him never shooting a single frame outside England. Of course, that's not counting the second unit footage. Sadly, he would not live to see the success of Eyes Wide Shut firsthand. On March 7, 1999, Stanley Kubrick died of a massive heart attack in his sleep, only days after he had turned in his finished cut of the film to the studio. After its premiere at the Venice Film Festival, Eyes Wide Shut opened to strong box office receipts and a mixed critical reaction. Some saw a profoundly flawed film, while others saw an unfinished masterpiece. The general perception at the time was that the infamous perfectionist had ultimately succumbed to that bittersweet brand of irony he had spent his career exploring, closing out his life's work with an incomplete, half-baked film. However, much like Kubrick's other work, time and repeat viewings have eroded that notion, revealing a thoroughly considered and impeccably crafted work that ranks among the best of the director's filmography. With Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick's life work was complete, and for all the innovation and excellence he had given the art form, he was rewarded with perhaps the best parting gift a filmmaker could hope for, a pitch-perfect finish. Every living filmmaker today works under the shadow of Stanley Kubrick. His rollercoaster ride of a career lasted 45 years and spanned two continents, leaving 14 features and countless innovations in its wake. In making his films, Kubrick ultimately wanted to change the form of cinema itself. His exploration of alternative story structures and new forms of expression resulted in several groundbreaking contributions to the development of the craft itself. He pioneered realistic visual effects with 2001: A Space Odyssey, generating what director Steven Spielberg called his generation's Big Bang, and inspiring a legion of upcoming filmmakers to push those boundaries even further. Kubrick's supreme command of his craft and knowledge of trick photography would result in the only Oscar he would ever win, for 2001's groundbreaking visual effects. The gold statue for directing her picture would evade him for his entire life. Other groundbreaking innovations that Kubrick popularized are well known: the specialized low-light lenses on Barry Lyndon, or the graceful gliding of the Steadicam on The Shining, to name just a few. Some of his innovations are less well known. His endorsement of Video Assist, a technology that allowed filmmakers to view a take immediately after filming it, directly contributed to its quick adoption throughout the industry. He also popularized the idea of shooting dozens of takes as a way for actors to let go of their preconceptions about technique and reach a deeper, fundamentally authentic style of performance, a practice that Kubrick acolyte David Fincher would claim as his own calling card. It's important to remember, however, that accumulating mountains of footage wasn't just a means to wear his actors down to raw nubs. Kubrick often found the final form of his films in the editing room, sifting through the dozens of takes and various angles he had explored on set and stitching it together into a unified whole. In that sense, he was a perfectionist in the best way, making sure that he left no stone unturned and realizing the full potential of any given project. Indeed, when he accepted the most prestigious directing award of his life from the DGA shortly before his death, he invoked the myth of Icarus in a videotaped speech that alluded to his perfectionism.
I've compared Griffith's career to the Icarus myth, but at the same time, I've never been certain whether the moral of the Icarus story should only be, as is generally accepted, don't try to fly too high, or whether it might also be thought of as, forget the wax and feathers and do a better job on the wings.
Kubrick's perfectionism meant that he had to spend long amounts of time on any given project, and he always regretted his slow pace. Like most other filmmakers, Kubrick abandoned a few projects over the course of his career, but unlike those other filmmakers, his unrealized works are regarded as great gifts that we'll never receive. Funnily enough, these films all involve his close friend and fellow director Steven Spielberg in some fashion. Kubrick's lifelong ambition to make a film on Napoleon Bonaparte is well known, so much so that it's widely called the greatest film never made. In a way, it would have been the most autobiographical film that Kubrick ever made. Both Kubrick and Napoleon were master strategists that were well aware of their brilliance. He no doubt would have drawn many parallels between the art of war and the art of filmmaking, seeing as both men approached their respective work with a totalitarian mentality. Kubrick's shooting script for Napoleon is now reportedly being developed by Spielberg as a television miniseries, so we may end up seeing the greatest film never made after all. Kubrick's other big failed project was a planned film about the Holocaust called The Aryan Papers, based off Louis Begley's book Wartime Lies. In a nod to Kubrick's companionship with Spielberg, it would have starred Jurassic Park's Joseph Mazzello as a young boy hiding from the Nazi regime as they persecuted Europe's Jews. Ironically, Kubrick abandoned the film after Spielberg released Schindler's List, perhaps the definitive narrative film about the Holocaust, in 1993. Finally, there's AI, artificial intelligence, a long gestating project that Kubrick sought to make himself, but ultimately decided to pass on to Spielberg to direct. After Kubrick's death in 1999, Spielberg was compelled to honor his old friend, and made the film as closely as he could to Kubrick's original vision. As arguably the single most influential filmmaker of all time, Kubrick leaves behind a substantial number of heirs and acolytes, and he will continue to do so as long as cinema remains a viable art form. While Steven Spielberg was greatly influenced by Kubrick and even became a close friend later in life, it could be argued that Spielberg's own distinct aesthetic disqualifies him as a true heir to Kubrick's cinematic legacy. Rather, he is more of an immediate beneficiary. Filmmakers like Christopher Nolan and Paul Thomas Anderson have modeled core conceits of their careers and aesthetics on Kubrick's example. But I, for one, would argue David Fincher as Kubrick's most direct successor. Yes, both men are infamous for their meticulous attention to detail and countless numbers of takes, but it's really their shared thematic explorations of the fragile human psyche, as well as their almost clinical observations of mankind's inherent darkness that bonds both artists to each other. Fincher's career simply wouldn't be possible if not for the paths that Kubrick so bravely paved a generation earlier. Like a large storm cloud, Kubrick's shadow looms over the cinematic landscape. He was a force of nature that permanently altered the art form, and while we may never get the gift of a new Kubrick film ever again, his legacy will continue to endure as long as there are uncompromising artists who are unafraid to gaze directly into the dark side of human nature.
Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.